Hollywood portrays characters like Norman Osborn as freakish exceptions. In reality, the capitalist can maximize profit only by putting business interests ahead of human needs. To make it in business, all capitalists must behave as if they are psychopaths, whether they are or not. Consider the following example of how one executive was handsomely rewarded for sacrificing children to meet the needs of his corporation. In 2002, Cardinal Bernard F. Law, head of the Archdiocese of Boston, was forced to resign for protecting priests who were sexually molesting children. Law had knowingly moved pedophile priests from parish to parish, where they molested even more children. After Law was disgraced for his role in the child abuse scandal, Pope John Paul II appointed him Archpriest of a Basilica in Rome, a highly influential position. Whether or not he was a psychopath, Law advanced his career by behaving like one. Henry Ford, founder of the Ford Corporation, built an automotive empire by sacrificing human lives. He once stated, "I am not in the business of making cars. I am in the business of making profit." This stance required Ford executives to function like psychopaths. Let's say you had a choice between manufacturing a dangerous vehicle or a safe one. What if the dangerous vehicle was more profitable, even after you included the cost of killing and injuring a certain number of people and generating a predictable number of lawsuits? In the late 1960s, the Ford Motor Company launched the Pinto, knowing that a rear-end collision of more than 30 miles an hour would jam its doors and cause a fuel tank explosion that would incinerate the occupants trapped inside. When asked about the Pinto's exploding gas tank, a Ford engineer admitted, quote, "That's all true, that the car tends to explode in minor accidents. But you miss the point entirely. You see, safety isn't the issue, trunk space is. You have no idea how stiff the competition is over trunk space. Do you realize that if we put a Capri-type tank in the Pinto, you could only get one set of golf clubs in the trunk?" Close quote. Ford developed a $6 modification to the Pinto that would prevent the gas tank from exploding. The company then did a cost-benefit analysis based on how many people might die from exploding gas tanks and how much money Ford would have to pay for each death, about $200,000 per person. This sum turned out to be less than the cost of modifying the fuel tanks of all Pintos, so Ford chose not to apply the modification. How many people died as a result? The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration began investigating automobile fires shortly after the Pinto began rolling off the assembly line. Every year, 400,000 cars were catching fire and burning more than 3,000 people to death. Even though Ford made only 24% of the vehicles on American roads, its cars accounted for 42% of collision-ruptured fuel tanks. It took 10 years for the Department of Transportation to declare that the Pinto had a, quote, safety-related defect. 1.5 million vehicles were recalled, and the Ford Motor Company was charged with reckless homicide. However, the judge acquitted Ford on the basis that it could not be convicted for doing what it was designed to do: make a profit. A society that values profit over people needs policymakers who act like psychopaths. Of course, most executives have social values. However, the greatest rewards are reserved for those who are willing to do whatever it takes to get ahead. In a society that rewards greed, good guys finish last. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN, Nashville, WUOW, Oneonta, KRBS, Oroville, WKNH, Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. We continue with Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. They don't care about us. We have no obligation to make history. We have no obligation to make art. We have no obligation to make a statement. To make money is our only objective. Michael Eisner, CEO of Disney. Governments claim to represent all the people. In practice, they serve business first and foremost. That is why the minimum wage is kept at $5.25 an hour, and why the rich are showered with billions of dollars in tax cuts. Automotive manufacturers continue to deny safety problems, and the state continues to shield them. In 2003, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration decided to, quote, forbid the public release of some data relating to unsafe motor vehicles, unquote, on the basis that publicizing the information would cause substantial competitive harm to manufacturers, close quote. Government loyalty to business is clearest in times of crisis. After the bombing of the World Trade Center, Congress authorized $15 billion in emergency aid to the nation's airlines. Thousands of laid-off airline workers got nothing. Even worse, the government's aid package required airlines to cut the wages and benefits of workers who remained on the job. While Congress took 17 days to rush relief to the airlines, it took 11 months to assemble the first compensation packages for victims' relatives. 25 families were offered a total of $34 million, or less than 0.25% of what the airlines got. More than a year after the tragedy, tens of thousands of people who had applied for emergency assistance were still waiting for their forms to be processed. If 9/11 left any doubts about government priorities, Hurricane Katrina blew them away 4 years later. Public officials knew 3 days in advance that Katrina was going to hit the Gulf Coast. They did nothing. No effort was made to evacuate hundreds of thousands of predominantly poor black people with no way to leave on their own. Sick and disabled people, old people, patients in hospitals and nursing homes, prisoners in locked cells, all were abandoned to the flood. People desperately searching for supplies to survive were branded as looters, and President Bush gave orders to shoot them on sight. After Hurricane Katrina, Congress voted $62 billion to kickstart, quote, one of the largest reconstruction efforts the world has ever seen, close quote. While well-connected companies lined up for the loot, the poor got a kick in the pants. The Davis-Bacon Act that prohibits employers from paying substandard wages on federally financed projects was suspended for contractors working in the Gulf Coast. New federal contractors were also relieved of any obligation to hire minorities, women, Vietnam veterans, and disabled people on Katrina-related projects. These measures were a boon to business, while forcing those who'd lost everything to work for next to nothing if they could find any work at all. Blaming human nature. Capitalism subordinates compassion, contributing, and cooperation to the pursuit of profit and blames the resulting social problems on human nature. Politicians know that corporate donations butter their bread and return the favor by opening the public purse for whatever business needs, subsidies, tax cuts, war, etc. Meanwhile, there is no, quote, political will to solve social problems like poverty and unemployment. On the contrary, public officials moan about the deficit and cut funds for education, housing, pensions, social assistance, and Medicare. The people at the top of society set the example for everyone else. When authorities display consistent disregard for human needs, it sends the message that humanity as a whole has no compassion. To support the view that human nature is basically selfish, many so-called experts insist that altruism or unselfish concern for others doesn't really exist. Cynics argue that people help others only when it benefits them to do so. Skeptics claim that people offer assistance only to reduce their own distress at witnessing suffering in others. Pessimists insist that people do the right thing only to avoid punishment. Of course, it feels good to help, and assisting others does reduce one's own distress. The question is whether the decision to help is always based on a cost-benefit analysis. Those who believe this refer to the brutal murder of Kitty Genovese in New York City in 1964. 38 people heard her screaming, and no one came to her aid or called the police. Does such behavior prove that people care only for themselves? Researchers set out to answer this question. To test the theory that people aid others only to reduce their own distress, subjects were given the opportunity of reducing their discomfort by escaping from the situation instead of helping. Most people chose to help, even when escape was easier. To investigate the possibility that people help in order to avoid guilt, shame, or punishment, subjects were provided with various excuses they could use to avoid helping, like being told that others had promised to provide aid. Once again, most people preferred to help, even when they had the option of feeling good about not helping. Finally, to discover if people help others only to feel good about themselves, researchers compared subjects who helped a victim with subjects who were informed that someone else had helped the victim. Most people felt just as good when they discovered that the victim had been helped as they felt when they were the ones who did the helping. Other studies show that toddlers as young as 18 months of age are eager to help, even when they are not rewarded for doing so. Add the countless examples of people moving to aid others with no thought to themselves, and we must conclude that human beings have a built-in desire to help that cannot be reduced to personal gain. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Compassion derailed. Although caring and cooperation are instinctive in human beings, we are not slaves to our biology. Social influences play an important role in shaping behavior. The need to urinate is biological. However, where we urinate is socially conditioned. When hunger strikes, we seldom grab the nearest piece of food. An amorous couple will stop their activities when interrupted by the doorbell. Compassion and cooperation are no different. They can be derailed by social conditions. Researchers into the Genovese murder found that compassion can be negated when people think that no real need exists, that they lack the ability to help, or that someone else will solve the problem. No real need exists. When is a scream a cry for help, and when is it a part of a heated argument? When people are uncertain, they may not react. People are more likely to respond to an obvious emergency, especially when others show concern. You cannot help. If people think they lack the skill, strength, or courage to help, they may hold back. Those who feel less confident are less likely to help, while those who feel good about themselves are more likely to help. Someone else will solve the problem. If people think that someone has already called for help, they are less likely to call themselves. If they know that others are unable to help, then they are more likely to act. These three messages, no real need exists, you cannot help, someone else will solve the problem, promote passivity. When President Ronald Reagan condemned welfare queens living high off the hog on social assistance, he was saying that no real need exists because these people are better off than you are. Similarly, the belief that, quote, the poor will always be with us assumes that nothing can be done to eliminate poverty. And when power is concentrated at the top of society, the message is that someone else will solve the problem. The few who rule the many must promote such leave-it-to-us passivity if they want to maintain their rule. Given the extent to which selfishness is modeled at the top of society and passivity promoted in the face of social problems, it is amazing that people care as much as they do. When governments refuse to assist the needy, ordinary people organize fundraising events and volunteer at distress centers, shelters, and soup kitchens. People spend countless unpaid hours raising children, caring for the sick and elderly, and generally supporting one another. Caring about others is so basic to human nature that most people can't understand how it could be displaced by self-interest. Take the example of Carolyn Kelly, age 81, who dove into deep water to save a fellow nursing home resident from drowning. Kelly swam out to the victim and held her head above water until paramedics arrived. When questioned by reporters, Kelly explained that she was a good swimmer and felt she had to help. Everyday heroes typically insist that anyone else would do the same in their place. The next chapter explains how too much pain can cause people to close their hearts in self-protection. Summary: when greed is profitable, compassion is not cost-effective. To justify heartless social priorities, quote, experts insist that selfishness is basic to human nature. Nevertheless, ordinary people value compassion and generosity because their everyday lives depend upon it. I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Chapter 3. Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken? Emotional pain can be so unbearable that feeling nothing at all can seem preferable. In a world of pain, nature provides a defense against suffering. Dissociation. Dissociation is a double-edged sword. It helps people tolerate what they cannot change. It also blocks awareness of the need for change. Dissociation was first identified in the late 19th century by Jean-Martin Charcot, a physician working at an asylum for the sick and destitute in France. Instead of dismissing his patients as raving lunatics, Charcot listened to them and concluded that they had been traumatized. Charcot's student Pierre Janet proposed that some experiences are so traumatic that they cannot be integrated into a person's understanding of the world, so they are split off from conscious awareness. In short, dissociation provides an escape when there is no escape. On hearing that her son had been killed, a mother reported feeling numb and unable to move, as if she were suspended in space. Unfortunately, dissociation has a price. Janet explained that dissociated fragments of experience can intrude into a person's consciousness as frightening thoughts, feelings, and images, compulsive behaviors, and physical symptoms. Feeling disconnected can also cause depression, anxiety, and low self-esteem. Efforts to counter the distress of dissociation can create more problems, including addictions, self-destructive behaviors, and violence towards others. For example, emotional numbness can be so disturbing that a person may engage in risky activities in order to feel something. Someone else may combat frightening mental images with obsessive thoughts and compulsive rituals. Another person may blame her sense of disconnection on someone else, become angry or violent toward that person, then feel ashamed and get drunk for relief. Despite the many problems it creates, Janet believed that dissociation helped people to cope with trauma by separating contradictory experiences to avoid inner conflict, triggering automatic self-preserving behaviors, disconnecting the sense of self from the intolerable experience. This new trauma-based approach to illness caused tremendous excitement in the medical world. In 1890 alone, 5 conferences on dissociation were held in Europe and the United States. In 1906, Janet was invited to give an inaugural series of lectures at Harvard Medical School. Distinguished scientists flocked to study under Charcot, including the 29-year-old Sigmund Freud, who traveled to Paris in 1885. While Charcot believed that any kind of trauma could make people sick, Freud insisted that childhood sexual abuse was the primary cause of nervous disorders. Back in Vienna, this theory proved very unpopular. In response, Freud did an about-turn and proclaimed that patients' stories of childhood sexual trauma were simply fantasies that should not be believed. Freud developed psychoanalysis on the basis that inner conflict, not external experience, was the cause of illness. In We've Had 100 Years of Psychotherapy and the World's Getting Worse, James Hillman and Michael Ventura point out that social problems cannot be solved by emphasizing what happens inside people's heads instead of in their lives. Janet's theory of traumatic dissociation became popular during a time of social rebellion. The following period was more conservative and favored Freud's theory. World War I revived the interest in the link between trauma and illness. Today, dissociation remains politically controversial because it places human suffering in a social context. Everyday dissociation. In The Stranger in the Mirror, Marlene Steinberg explains that dissociation is far more common than people think. While severe forms of dissociation occur in response to traumatic events, mild or moderate experiences of dissociation are as common in otherwise normal people as anxiety and depression. Close quote. Such experiences include not recognizing yourself in the mirror, staring into space and losing track of time, being uncertain whether a memory was from a dream or reality, feeling outside of oneself, both as an observer and a participant, feeling that one was watching a movie of one's progression through life, experiencing a numbing of emotions, missing parts of conversations, and being unable to remember something one has just done. Dissociation is common because the world is full of contradictory, distressing experiences. Every day, most people go to jobs where they have no control over what they do. Everywhere, the few dominate the many, and immense wealth exists alongside enormous deprivation. Unfairness normally generates anger that pushes us to set things right. Feeling powerless to correct what is wrong is frightening. So people don't think about it. They dissociate. The media promotes such dissociation. A newspaper report on famine is placed next to an advertisement for expensive jewelry. The reader looks at the report and feels bad about people starving, then sees the advertisement and admires the jewelry, or vice versa. The physical separation between the two items encourages this switch in feelings. The question of why some people can't afford food while others can afford diamonds is also avoided. Dissociation allows people to respond to conflicting aspects of life as if they were not related. Through the mechanism of dissociation, divisions within society are reproduced within the human mind. Lack of control over work, called alienation, results in psychological dissociation from the work process. People feel disconnected from their labor, from themselves, from each other, and from the world. While dissociation provides temporary comfort, it allows oppression, exploitation, and inequality to continue. Dissociation in the face of injustice is mistakenly perceived as a lack of caring instead of what it really is, a psychological defense against the inability to turn caring into action. Doublespeak. In the futuristic novel 1984, the main character works at the Ministry of Truth, where his job is deleting facts from the public records. To eliminate internal conflict over what he does, he convinces himself that the version of history he creates every day is real. The author uses the term doublethink to describe how someone can believe two contradictory things at the same time. Doublespeak is a similar form of dissociation that is used to make the unacceptable acceptable, like calling welfare cuts back-to-work measures. Doublespeak is used regularly by governments, corporations, media, advertisers, and the military. The more reprehensible the action, the more lies are needed to make it palatable. Not surprisingly, the military takes the prize for doublespeak. War is defense. Death is collateral damage. A freedom fighter is a terrorist working for us, and a terrorist is a freedom fighter working for them. Politicians are especially skilled at doublespeak. While the U.S. was bombing Afghanistan and killing innocent people, President George W. Bush appealed to Americans to send money to the White House to help Afghan children. School students prepared care packages for Afghan refugees, and the United Nations pledged that year's Halloween UNICEF collection to Afghan children. What's wrong with this picture? Knowing that most people are repulsed by mass murder, warmongers make humanitarian gestures to present themselves as compassionate people with good intentions. Expressing concern for those who attack and urging people to rally around your concern channels distress about war into activities that support war and those who wage it. When anti-war activists pointed out the contradiction of sending aid to Afghanistan and bombing the country at the same time, many people reacted with hostility. It is impossible to reconcile the image of America as a savior of the oppressed with the image of America as a terrorist state. Official doublespeak made it easier for people to dissociate from the fact that their government was conducting mass murder in their name. Doublespeak invites people to dissociate, and dissociation helps people to accept contradictions, to love their own children and support wars that kill other people's children, to want help when they run into trouble and condemn others needing social assistance, to feel anger at being hurt and defend those who hurt them. When thinking brings pain, dissociation helps people move through life without thinking. Doublespeak also helps wrongdoers dissociate. When people in power who are not psychopaths are compelled to act like psychopaths, when they can reach their goals only by harming others, they must dissociate. They cannot allow themselves to feel compassion for their victims, or they would be unable to do their jobs. They must convince themselves that they are doing the right thing. They must believe their own lies. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Under severe stress, the body produces pain-killing chemicals called internal opiates that are identical to external opiates like morphine and heroin. These chemicals block fear and pain so the wounded can escape to safety. Injured soldiers and accident victims often report feeling no pain for some time. When there is no escape, these same opiates make death easier. Internal opiates contribute to the dissociated or altered states of consciousness that occur during severe stress. There may be some sense of detachment. I floated out of my body. Feelings of unreality. It was like watching a movie. An altered sense of time. Time stood still. Automatic movements. It was like a higher power took over, and feeling numb. This state of mind is featured in the movie Fearless. The main character is a passenger on an airplane that is about to crash. At first, he is terrified. When he realizes he cannot escape death, he becomes calm, even blissful, despite the chaos around him. In a world of uncertainty, danger, and pain, dissociation functions like a welcome drug. The unbearable can be tolerated when emotions are numbed. However, there is a cost. Dissociation numbs all emotions, including the positive ones, making life seem flat and empty. Severe dissociation numbs feelings of compassion and empathy, making it possible for people to do cruel and monstrous things that they would never do in a non-dissociated state. Milder forms of dissociation make it easier to live as if the world were more safe and more fair than it really is. Being comfortably numb also has a price. Recall the cartoon ostrich that buries its head in the sand, only to be kicked in the butt. By numbing fear, anger, and pain, dissociation reduces motivation to solve problems that should be solved. It used to puzzle me that people would change the subject when I talked about social problems. At first, I assumed they didn't care. It took some time before I realized that discussing problems can make people feel powerless and frustrated when they think there is no solution. People have a limited tolerance for pain, and it makes sense to avoid what you think you cannot change. One man confessed that he dodges beggars on the street because he feels so bad that he can't help. A woman admitted outright, "If I don't care, then it won't hurt so much." People don't need to care more. They need more solutions. Believing that a problem can be solved makes it possible to bear the pain of that problem. The next chapter explains how people's natural problem-solving abilities are discouraged by society. Summary: people dissociate in response to painful contradictions and seemingly unsolvable problems. Dissociation makes feeling powerless more tolerable, while allowing intolerable situations to continue. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Chapter 4, Nature's Youngest Child. Some say that human beings are little more than animals in clothing. with savage natures that lurk beneath a thin veneer of civilization. Others insist that people are nothing like animals at all. In reality, the human species is both animal and more than animal, with a unique ability to shape its own history. Animals have amazing abilities. By smell alone, a rescue dog can find someone buried beneath the snow. Some animals can detect cancer in human beings. Others can sense impending earthquakes. Animals are particularly adept at finding food, in the wild, on kitchen counters, and behind cupboard doors. However, no species can match the human ability to transform fantasy into reality. No other animal can look at a field full of stones, imagine biting into a luscious cob of corn, make a plan, and enlist others to help, then persevere for months, hauling rocks, plowing, planting, weeding, watering, and waiting, until a field of ripe corn is ready to harvest. Bees construct hives based on geometric patterns that, while intricate, never change. Human beings can imagine and build an unlimited variety of structures. Furthermore, people accumulate knowledge and skill from generation to generation so that the ability to imagine and the ability to construct continually evolve. Compared with dinosaurs who lived for millions of years, the human species is very young, about 150,000 years old. As nature's youngest child, humanity has barely begun to explore its potential. How important is biology? All mammals have a biological bonding system because the newborn's connection to its mother is essential for survival. This bonding system functions like an emotional umbilical cord connecting dependent offspring to adults who can nurture and protect them. The human bonding system is especially important. Children take years to learn how to control their bodies, regulate their emotions, use language, and master social skills. This long process of development is rooted in biology and shaped by experience. The newborn infant has a surplus of connections among brain cells. Experience prunes these connections and organizes the brain. The human attachment system orchestrates this complex dance between biology and experience. In The Developing Mind, How Relationships and the Brain Interact to Shape Who We Are, Daniel Siegel explains that interactions between adults and children literally shape the child's brain, determining which nerve cells develop connections, which ones disconnect from lack of use, and how the developing systems of the brain relate to each other, to the rest of the body, and to the external world. For example, all children are born with language abilities. However, they learn to speak only those languages that are spoken to them. In short, our thoughts, feelings, and sense of self are all shaped by our relationships. Throughout life, the brain shapes and reshapes itself in response to new experiences. A study of dyslexic children found their brain activity to be different from children without dyslexia. People with dyslexia have difficulty reading, recognizing the meaning of words, and spelling accurately. After completing a treatment program that improved their reading, the brain patterns of children with dyslexia had become the same as the brain patterns of children without dyslexia. The adult brain can also reshape itself. When a 35-year-old man lost both hands in an accident, his brain reorganized itself, delegating his elbows to be his new hands. After he underwent a double hand transplant, his brain reorganized itself again to permit his new hands to function. The lifelong flexibility of the brain makes human beings the most adaptable species on the planet. Many animals organize themselves into societies. Bees build hives, geese flock together, and wolves live in packs. These species always organize themselves in the same ways. A beehive in one location is like a beehive anywhere else, and the beehives have remained basically the same for thousands of years. In contrast, human beings change their social arrangements to meet their changing needs. People have learned to live in all climates and in every geographic location. We have constructed egalitarian societies as well as societies with sharp class divisions. We have built societies where men and women played equal roles, others where women were superior, and still others where men were superior. People of different origins have lived together as equals, and they have also enslaved one another. We have lived for eons in cooperation and suffered centuries of warfare. Different human societies promote different values. Pre-class societies valued reciprocity, while class societies value competition. Homosexuality was revered by the upper class in ancient Greece and reviled by the upper class in Victorian England. A flexible brain and a highly social nature make it possible for human beings to solve problems by changing how they live. However, the people in power oppose change because they benefit from the way things are. They and their supporters insist that society can be organized in only one way, the way it is now. Such inflexibility blocks our ability to respond to environmental and social challenges. A fright-filled world. In the 21st century, most of the threats faced by our ancient ancestors have been eliminated. Rarely is someone eaten by a larger animal. Modern agriculture has made possible an abundant supply of food. We know how to prevent and cure many diseases. We can construct shelters for every possible environment. Our ancestors would be greatly impressed with these achievements and assume that we must live happy lives, free from fear. If only this were true. The dangers of the natural world have been replaced with new dangers created by human beings. Modern society is divided into antagonistic social classes. Some get rich on the food trade, while others starve because they cannot pay for food. Drug companies make huge profits while millions die for lack of medicines. Banks, builders, and landlords make fortunes in real estate while homeless families sleep on the streets. Fortunes are invested in training Olympic athletes while youngsters lack access to sports programs. In this class-divided world, the rich and powerful protect themselves at the expense of everyone else. Before Enron declared bankruptcy in 2001, its executives emptied the cash box. About 500 executives took bonuses ranging from $1,000 to $5 million each. When Enron shares plummeted, executives sold their stock while barring workers from selling theirs. The top dogs at Enron took care of themselves, leaving Enron employees stripped of their jobs, benefits, life savings, and pensions. For the majority of people, the world is a dangerous and unpredictable place. Like Enron workers, most people have no control over their jobs, the job market, or the state of the economy. Ordinary people do not control foreign policy or the decision to go to war, although they pay for and die in those wars. People who live without power live in fear. Animal defenses. A strong fear response is hardwired into the human brain. Human beings evolved from animals that were prey, not predators. For prey, the best defense is fear. All primates learn fear quickly and easily. Young monkeys who were previously indifferent to snakes acquire an intense fear of them when they observe another monkey display a fearful reaction, even though no actual harm is experienced or observed. Consider the emotional impact of the movie Jaws. The rhythmic, menacing sound that signals the shark's approach produces a strong fear reaction, despite the fact that most people will never see a real shark, let alone be attacked by one. Animal defenses are rooted in human emotions. The word emotion is derived from the Latin verb emovere, which means to move. Emotions pull us away from what is dangerous. Heights, thunderstorms, predators, and push us toward what we desire, food, warmth, companions. Disgust and shame move us away from others, while empathy and curiosity move us towards them. People don't realize how frequently their animal defenses are triggered. Danger activates a fear response that consists of several steps. The first priority is to locate and identify the danger. When a group of people hear a loud crash outside, all conversation stops. All activity stops. People look at each other asking, "What was that?" They move to a window to find out. Normal activity will not resume until people know whether protective action is required. When this knowledge is withheld or unavailable, people become fearful and unable to concentrate on anything else. The orienting response to danger causes drivers to slow down near accidents and survey the scene. They tie up traffic and irritate those who are trying to clear the roads. Radio announcers make derogatory comments about rubberneckers. Police wave cars on and impatiently push onlookers away. Yet people are compelled to look. The need to assess danger is instinctive. Once danger has been identified, the brain sets automatic responses into motion. The safest option is to flee. When there is not enough strength, time, or room to run, the brain will ready the body to fight. When neither flight nor fight seems possible, the strategy of last resort is to dissociate, which is also called submitting, freezing, or playing dead. Animal defenses are also activated in response to low levels of threat. If reading this book threatens your beliefs, you might put it down and avoid picking it up again, flight. You might get angry and throw the book in the garbage, fight. Or you might go over the same page repeatedly without retaining anything, dissociate. In response to a threatening conversation, you might change the subject, flight. Or get angry, fight, or appear to listen while you think about something else, dissociate. You take a different route to work to avoid your ex, flight. You fume when your dog chews on your shoe, fight. You go blank during an exam, dissociate. Animal defenses are instinctive and automatic, yet society values some reactions over other. The fight response is prized most highly because it is associated with power. Soldiers who enter a fear-induced killing frenzy, fight reaction, are commended. Those who run or freeze are condemned. Women who fight or flee their rapists are praised. Those who dissociate are wrongly accused of consenting. Dissociated defenses are most disdained as a sign of powerlessness. Mistaken morality causes people to feel guilty or ashamed about how they react to danger. They may curse themselves for running when they thought they should have fought, or for freezing when they thought they should have run. Other people, including professionals, compound the problem when they question why someone, quote, chose to react one way instead of another. In fact, the type of defense used is determined by subconscious brain centers that rapidly assess the best way to survive, set the response in motion, and only then inform the conscious mind of what is happening. By saving time, automatic behavior improves the chance of surviving, and survival is nature's highest value. The fearsome predators of today are not large animals, but corporations, governments, and institutions that devour human lives for profit. Animal defenses cannot protect us from these predators. Recall the Ford Pinto. Most people feel horror when they think about burning to death in their cars. They feel fear that someone they love might die that way. They feel angry that Ford got away with calculated mass murder. When people experience strong emotions, their bodies are pushing them to do something now. Unfortunately, emotional responses cannot solve complex social problems. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. The emotion of injustice. Imagine your town's wealthiest family throws a lavish party costing many times more than your annual income. You're not invited, but you get the bill. Worse, they plan to throw increasingly lavish parties every year and want you to shortchange your family, cash in your savings, and postpone retirement to pay for them. You'd be outraged. Holly Sklar. All social animals have a built-in sense of fairness. Two dogs will fight when only one is offered a bone. When treats are equally dispensed, everyone is happy. The sense of fairness is even more developed in primates. Monkeys will refuse to perform when they see other monkeys getting better rewards than they get for the same effort. Human beings can tell the difference between being treated fairly and being cheated. They don't need to be taught this. They feel it in their gut. Who hasn't heard a young child protest, "It's not fair, and he got more than I did"? While fairness is essential for harmonious social living, it takes conscious effort to ensure that relationships are fair. Egalitarian societies develop complex customs to promote fairness. West Coast Aboriginal peoples arranged parties where desired goods would be given away, exchanged, or even destroyed to prevent resentment that results when some have more than they need while others go without. At every age, in all cultures, and throughout time, unfairness has evoked anger in human beings. Anger is the emotion of injustice. Anger screams, "Something is wrong," and provides energy to set things right. The beginning of class divisions marked the beginning of rebellions by the ruled against their rulers. From the slave uprisings of the ancient world, through the peasant revolts that swept Europe during the Middle Ages, to the working class revolts that rocked the 20th century, people have fought for their right to an equal say and an equal share. Anger results when some are denied what is available to others: jobs, housing, access to education, medical treatment, social support, etc. The have-nots may live with simmering resentment or rebel openly. Either way, the awareness of inequality is a constant irritant. Because inequality generates rebellion, unequal societies must create penal systems to crush those who rebel. When anger is stimulated and its expression is blocked, emotions can build to an intolerable level. Anger warns us that something is wrong and provides energy to act. However, no emotion on its own can tell us what is wrong or how to make it right. Without this information, anger could be unleashed in ways that backfire, or it can be squandered in useless activities that only blow off steam. A good example is the worker who is humiliated by her supervisor every day, and she fears she will lose her job if she fights back. Her frustrated anger can become dissociated from her supervisor and misdirected against herself or her workmates, family members, pets, neighbors, or anyone who crosses her path. The phrase "going postal" refers to U.S. postal workers who became so stressed that they lost it and attacked their supervisors and co-workers, often killing themselves as well. Misdirected anger does not solve problems. On the contrary, dumping anger on innocent bystanders and loved ones can produce guilt and shame and generate more anger. Anger is most powerful when it is organized and focused on a specific goal. In 1997, the South African government passed a law allowing it to import or produce cheaper versions of expensive medicines to treat HIV/AIDS. In response, a cartel of 39 drug companies sued the South African government for bypassing their drug patents and threatening their profits. The U.S. government backed the drug companies and threatened to boycott South Africa unless it dropped the law. The injustice of this situation enraged many people around the world. They organized in such large numbers and so effectively that they forced both the U.S. government and the drug cartel to back down. Emotional hijack. Human beings have a unique ability to analyze and solve complex problems. However, strong emotions release stress hormones that can hijack the brain and prevent clear thinking. Common metaphors like "out of his head with grief," "loose cannon," and "consumed by lust" describe how intense feelings can overwhelm common sense. Automatic reactions helped our ancestors to survive animal predators when taking time to think might have been fatal. The military exploits the link between stress and automatic reactions to ensure that soldiers will kill on command without thinking. Such training can be difficult to contain. In 2002, a series of murders and suicides rocked the Fort Bragg military base. Just 2 days back from the war in Afghanistan, Rigoberto Nieves shot and killed his wife and then himself. Back from the war for only a month, William Wright killed his wife. 6 months after returning from Afghanistan, Brandon Floyd shot his wife and then himself. Former Air Force Captain Dorothy Mackey explains, The military members who are committing these attacks are, in fact, trained to be this violent. This is a lack of restraint, a lack of humanity that's drilled into them. Close quote. Danger stimulates strong emotions that cause people to behave without thinking. However, social problems require social solutions based on reasoned problem solving. The solution to this contradiction is an organized defense. There is safety in numbers. In response to danger, a group of people can calm each other enough to analyze and solve complex problems. However, when authorities prevent collective problem solving, people resort to animal defenses, as the following example shows. Slaughtering chickens is notoriously dirty, dangerous, and low paid. Anyone doing such work would have to dissociate. In 2004, it was revealed that workers at a chicken processing plant in Moorefield, West Virginia, were torturing chickens with the apparent approval of management. The incidents increased when employees were forced to work overtime. No doubt their anger against the chickens was aroused by unbearable working conditions. No doubt their supervisors preferred workers to unleash their anger on the chickens instead of organizing to demand humane conditions for themselves and for the chickens. Exploiting fear. The world can seem wonderful or horrible, depending on which emotions are stimulated. Advertisers use images of children and animals to evoke positive emotions and attract customers. The media do the opposite. The media slogan, "If it bleeds, it leads," reveals how danger is used to capture people's attention. While a media focus on crime, cruelty, and disaster is profitable, it creates a distorted view of the world that makes people more fearful. In response to the highly publicized murders of 2 10-year-old girls, a couple in England decided to implant a global positioning microchip in their daughter's arm so they could find her if she was abducted. The media, the police, and the military exaggerate danger to serve their needs. The automotive industry minimizes danger for the same reason. Automobiles are promoted as safe family fun, despite the fact that children are more likely to be killed by cars than abducted by strangers. In rich nations, vehicles are the leading cause of child death. Such facts are not allowed to undermine car sales and car profits. When people's emotions are so regularly manipulated, it can be difficult to know what is real. Politicians are notorious for manipulating people's emotions. During the buildup to the U.S. war against Afghanistan, public officials used fear as a weapon of mass deception. Most Americans viewed the attack on the World Trade Center on television and were in no immediate danger. They wanted to know what had happened and why. However, mainstream media discouraged thoughtful discussion by emphasizing the horror of the tragedy. Dramatic footage of the towers collapsing and people screaming and jumping out of the windows was shown repeatedly around the clock. People were hypnotically glued to their television sets, watching planes strike the buildings hundreds of times, day after day. Gruesome images multiplied on the covers of newspapers and magazines. The entire population was engulfed in a relentless horror. A study conducted a few days after 9/11 found that 71% of Americans felt depressed, 49% had difficulty concentrating, and 33% were suffering from insomnia. The American Psychological Association was concerned about how much fear was being stimulated. Their website explains, quote, "If a person can form a mental image of themselves, their children, or their loved ones in a life-threatening situation, he or she feels vulnerable. Statistics show that while becoming the victim of further terrorism is unlikely for the great majority of Americans, the images of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon can supersede people's rational perception of what is dangerous," close quote. Suppressing rational perception was the goal. When a parade of politicians, experts, and media commentators cries that danger is looming and war is the only response, people find this message hard to resist. Fear compels us to do something now, even though that something might create more danger. Panic demands that someone set things right, even when that someone can't be trusted. A panicked population was pointed in the wrong direction. The enemy is over there. Those who tried to think through the situation were denounced as unfeeling, condemned as disloyal, and accused of supporting the enemy. To silence the opposition, President Bush threatened, "Whoever is not with us is against us." In fact, Washington's had planned to invade Afghanistan before September 11th, when the Taliban rejected a U.S. proposal to construct an oil pipeline through their country. When this information became public a few months after 9/11, Vice President Dick Cheney and FBI Director Robert Mueller warned of the possibility of further terrorist attacks. In a rare fit of honesty, White House officials later told reporters that these warnings were issued not because of any increased threat, but to deflect criticism that was coming from political opponents. The fear of imminent danger was also used to sell war against Iraq. After the U.S. invasion, when no weapons of mass destruction could be found, when no link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda could be found, when it became clear that the president had lied and all the reasons for the war were false, the U.S. continued to occupy Iraq and suppress all resistance. Why? For years, the U.S. had wanted more military bases in the Middle East to control the world's largest supply of oil. The problem was how to convince American people to back such a plan. The attacks of 9/11 offered the perfect opportunity. The dog and pony show about weapons of mass destruction, defense of the nation, evil dictators, and promoting democracy provided the needed cover for an oil grab. Joseph Schumpeter describes how exaggerating the threat of danger to support imperial expansion is a political tactic that dates back to the early Roman Empire. Quote, "There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were those of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. When it was utterly impossible to contrive such an interest, why then it was the national honor that had been insulted. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their indubitably aggressive designs." Close quote. Today, the United States dominates the world with overwhelming military power. In 2003, the U.S. Department of Defense reported that it had more than 700 American military bases in 130 countries, in addition to the 6,000 bases on U.S. territory. The report did not include bases in Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Iraq, nor did it include the State of Israel, America's largest and best-funded military base. Furthermore, the number of bases in each country was underestimated. For example, only one of the 10 bases in Okinawa, Japan was counted. A more realistic estimate would be 1,000 American military bases outside the United States. Despite a half-trillion-dollar, quote, defense budget, the United States has not been invaded since 1812, when Canadian forces burned the White House. As serious as it was, the attack on 9/11 pales in comparison to the savage destruction that U.S. forces periodically inflict on other nations. Stoking the fear of further attacks in order to expand the empire does not increase public safety. On the contrary, military aggression increases the risk of retaliation. U.S. wars in the Middle East bring power and profit to the ruling class, while making the world more dangerous for everyone else. I've been reading From Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. We'll continue next week. In the meantime, you can get more information and a copy of the book at susanrosenthal.com. You can download an MP3 of this program, as well as email me questions for Dr. Rosenthal at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.